Hello again, and welcome to another iSci Flyby show. In recent weeks, we've talked about some important topics, but none more profound than the one we're examining today. It's the question of whether or not we are alone in the universe. Is this beautiful planet of ours the only place in the entire universe that hosts life, or is it something that is part and parcel of every galaxy, perhaps even most solar systems? In the past 20 years, we've begun to look seriously for life in our own solar system. So did Mars once harbour life? Does Venus to this day? And what secrets do the icy surfaces of the moons of the outer planets hold? We put these questions to one of the UK's most eminent astrobiologists, Professor Ian Crawford, who leads the Department of Planetary Physics and Astrobiology at Birkbeck College at the University of London. In this first part, he takes us on a fascinating tour of Mars and Venus and hints at intriguing possibilities on the icy moons.
So thanks very much for joining us today, Professor Ian Crawford. We have a number of questions to ask you on astrobiology, and it's a really fascinating subject. But how do you define it as a subject? What does it actually do and cover?
Well, broadly defined, astrobiology is about the searching for life in the universe. It's not the study of aliens, because we haven't discovered any aliens yet. So it's really the science of searching for life elsewhere. That's my take on astrobiology. If extraterrestrial life ever is discovered, then of course that will fall to the biologists. I mean, biology is the science of life. So astrobiology is really the science of searching for life in the universe.
So how do you go about that? How do you actually search for life? I mean, obviously, we haven't yet been able to get to planets like Mars or Jupiter or Venus to do the searches in person. But what do you actually do?
Well, there are several strands to this. I mean, of course, we have got robots. Robots are on Mars, which are kind of making a start looking for life on Mars.
Of course.
But I think there are really three strands, really, that have made astrobiology a discipline, a scientific discipline in the last few decades. One is a progress in terrestrial biology, and this is the understanding that life occupies much more extreme environments on our own planet than was once thought possible. And so these are so-called extremophiles, life which to our sort of anthropocentric perspective seems to live in extreme environments. Or from their perspective,
against all odds,
and it's we who are living in extreme environment. But anyway, we discover these mostly microbes that live in these very extreme environments. And as we've done that, we've realized some of these extreme environments are so extreme that they overlap with conditions that are probably occur on other planets. And so if life can exist on these extreme environments on Earth, then in principle, it could exist on these other planets as well. So that's one thing. The second thing is the search for life elsewhere in the solar system, which has only been going on with robotic spacecraft so far. But as we've explored the solar system through our spacecraft, we found places that look like they either are habitable. So, for example, ocean worlds in the icy moons of the outer solar system, or were once habitable, like Mars. As we've understood Mars, I mean, it's clear that Mars today is a very inhospitable place. But as we've understood its history better, it looks like billions of years ago, it was much more habitable with rivers and lakes and liquid water on the surface. So ancient Mars looks like it was habitable. So this raises the question as to whether life could have evolved on Mars. And that's what we're trying to find out. And the third big pillar of astrobiology is the discovery that planets are common in the universe. So prior to the mid-1990s, we hadn't discovered any other planets orbiting any other stars. I mean, astronomers had assumed these planets were common, but nobody knew. And now in the last 20 years, we've discovered thousands of them. And now that we've got some statistics, it looks like to a first approximation, all stars have planets. So to the extent that life requires planets, then there's billions and billions, trillions of planets in the universe. So these are the three main strands which have led to astrobiology being established as a discipline. I'll pause there.
Follow up. So you're looking for life, but what really defines life? What is an astrobiologist looking for in terms of signatures?
So this is a kind of, thorny question. There is no there is no universally agreed definition for what life is on the Earth among biologists. I mean, we've got some working definitions, but whenever you come across one that you think is all-inclusive, then you find exceptions. So we haven't actually really got, it's probably a mistake to try and define life first.
Okay.
And then go out to look for it, because that could exclude you finding things that are of great value and indeed might turn out to be defined as life later on. So it's kind of a sense that we'd recognize it when we see it. I mean, obviously, yeah, all the common definitions of life we would kind of be aware of, like life reproduces itself, life evolves through natural selection, life consumes energy, and so locally, in scientific terms, it's got very sort of negative entropy. It's highly ordered. And become life living systems are highly ordered, very intricate biochemistry, very intricate internal systems, and they maintain this intricate internal ordering by extracting energy from their environment, and then they can reproduce themselves and pass on this complexity through time. So these are the kind of attributes that life has, and therefore they're the kind of things that we'd be looking for elsewhere. But of course, immediately there is a very important, it is a distinction to be made about life elsewhere in the solar system. And so let's take Mars. There are clearly at least two possibilities for life on Mars, assuming there is any.
Right.
One is that life evolved on Mars independently and had a separate origin. This would be scientifically the most interesting result of all. But the other possibility is that life transfers itself between planets by catching rides on meteorites. So, for example, we've got Martian meteorites on the Earth. It's right. Highly likely there are Earth meteorites on Mars. Since there has been life on the Earth for a long time, any Earth meteorites on Mars could have transported Earth life to Mars. And so immediately that we find, if we are so fortunate to find life on Mars, this is the very next question that has to be asked. Is it independently originated life on Mars, or is it Earth life that's migrated to Mars? Of course, in the latter case, we'd instantly recognize it because it would have our genetic code. It would be based on our biochemistry. Yeah. But anyway, this would be an important problem to solve, but it would be a nice problem to have, of course, because the most exciting thing would be discovering life on Mars. And then we'd have to ask, is it really an independently evolved life, an independently originated life, yeah, or is it just Earth life that's spread through from Earth to Mars?
Some time ago, Ian, there was something in the press about a rock that had been found from a meteorite, or maybe one of the ones that the Mars rovers had found, which had so-called evidence of microbes within it. Did you see that, or do you think that's got any validity?
Well, I certainly, if you're referring to the Allen Hills 84001 meteorite, this was...
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this is the one that hit the press in about 1998. This is what had Bill Clinton speaking about it on the White House lawn.
Yeah.
I think the alleged evidence for life in that meteorite hasn't stood the test of time.
Right.
So there is no... having said this, the original authors of that paper that claim to have found life in that meteorite are still adamant that they did discover life in that meteorite, of course. But there's now been over 20 years of other workers studying this meteorite, and I think we'd know by now if that evidence had stacked up, and it doesn't. So that's a bit disappointing. There's no evidence in that particular meteorite. But of course, that doesn't tell us whether there's been life on Mars or not. A negative detection of life on one random meteorite from Mars doesn't tell us very much. The only way to get to the bottom of this question properly is to go to Mars and study it in situ. And on a much bigger scale than anything that's been attempted to date.
So do you think that targeting, as I think we are on some of the next moon Mars shots, targeting the icy north and south poles would be more conducive to finding life?
There are several issues here. If we just talking about Mars, I mean, we mustn't forget about the rest of the solar system.
Because of course.
There are other possibilities. considering Mars, there are really three possibilities, or four, I suppose. One is that there's never been any life on Mars. I mean, that would be important to find out, because that would then begs the question as to why not, especially as early Mars seems to have had habitable environments. So that would be an interesting puzzle, but difficult to prove a negative. Difficult to, however well we explore Mars, difficult to prove that life has never existed on the planet. If life has existed on the planet, then there are still several possibilities. One is it could have existed on Mars long ago, when Mars seems to be more habitable. Martian environment has changed drastically over time. The surface is now very inhospitable. Probably surface life is extinct. So in that scenario, we'd be looking for fossils. The search for life on Mars would be looking for fossil life, and almost certainly fossil microbes. It would be micropaleontology, looking for fossilized microbes. The second possibility is that life did originate on Mars early on. The surface conditions deteriorated. The surface is still uninhabited because it's now uninhabitable. But that in the deep subsurface, then habitable environments might still exist, again, for microbes. So these would be subsurface aquifers, which would be bodies of water trapped in the crustal rocks. Good evidence for aquifers on Mars. Microorganisms do exist in aquifers on the Earth. So potentially these would be habitable environments on Mars, but difficult for us to access.
Yeah.
The third possibility is that miraculously life arose on Mars, might be hanging on at the surface or very near the surface. And this is the only bit of Mars that currently we have access to. So this is where we have to look. But these are the most unlikely, I mean, the most inhospitable surface. The most inhospitable part of modern Mars is the surface, and that's the only place we have easy access to. So our prospects for finding extant life on the current surface of Mars, I think, are really slim. Doesn't stop us looking, but I think they're really slim. Whereas the possibility of deep subsurface life today is much higher. The possibility of fossil life from extinct ancient life also seems quite plausible. But of course, all of these require different techniques to search for these different evidences of life. They'd require different types of spacecraft with different types of instruments. And so really, we've only just made a start by looking at the current surface of Mars. But we have to just realize that's the least likely place we're going to find life, because it's the least hospitable part of the planet.
One of the things that we found on Earth is that life exists in all sorts of very inhospitable places, like the deep volcanic vents under the Atlantic Ocean so on. Is there any chance that on Mars, near volcanic activity, there would be signs of life, do you think?
Yes, with some caveats. I mean, you're right. Hydrothermal systems on the Earth are places where extremophiles do eke out a living, and in more than that, in the deep sea hydrothermal vents, that life positively thrives in those environments. The problem, and in the past, Mars has been a very volcanically active planet, and it has had liquid water on the surface and near the surface, so there will have been lots of opportunities for hydrothermal activity which could provide habitable environments. Of course, Martian volcanism has now, we don't necessarily know that it's extinct. We don't know of any active volcanism on Mars today. On the other hand, there are large volcanoes which are at least geologically recent, but geologically recent means they probably were active hundreds of millions of years ago. So it's likely, I mean, these would be fascinating. Ancient hydrothermal vents, hydrothermal deposits on Mars, they will be, and they are, very important places to search for evidence of past life on Mars. Again, it's difficult to see. Well, we don't know of any currently active hydrothermal systems which we could explore temporary life on Mars. So I think that would be a long shot.
In terms of then, everyone's hypothesizing constantly, like, was there ever water on Mars? Is water and life inherently linked on these sorts of searches for life?
Yes, but there are two things to say about that. I mean, it's in no sense debatable whether there was water on Mars or not. It's obvious that there was water on Mars because we see the evidence of the dried up river valleys, the crater lakes, the sedimentary rocks. Now, of course, the minerals, clay minerals that you obtain by eroding igneous basaltic rocks, lava with water produces clay minerals.
Right.
Now we've got these clay, and these are common on Mars. So that the really, I mean, I know that there is this constant excitement every time a new spacecraft allegedly finds evidence for liquid water having been present on Mars, as if it's some great discovery. We've known that Mars had liquid water on its surface at least from whenever Mariner 9 orbited the planet. So that would have been 72, something like that. Yeah. And I want to check the date. So there is no doubt that ancient Mars had water on its surface. Of course, current Mars does not and cannot have liquid water on its surface because current Mars is too cold. And the atmospheric pressure on Mars, which is 6 millibars on average, is so low that any water that did exist on the surface would quickly evaporate. Well, it would boil because the atmosphere containing atmospheric pressure. And what didn't boil would stay frozen in the ground. So liquid water is not stable on Mars today, but it absolutely has existed in the past. And that is why we can be confident that early Mars was habitable. So, yeah, that brings me to this linkage between life and water. So we've got to be a little bit careful here because we are a bit Earth life centric here. Our Earth life does require water. For multiple reasons. It doesn't follow that anything that we might consider to be alive would necessarily need liquid water, but one might think of alternatives. Perhaps we'll talk about the outer solar system a bit later. By places like Titan with lakes of liquid methane, you could ask whether liquid methane was a sufficient solvent to biology. Well, it isn't for our biology, but you could imagine an alien biology that might be able to use liquid methane. Yeah. So in a sense, many of our searches for life on Mars, they are searching for the kind of life that we already know. And that is liquid water-based life, because Earth life is liquid water-based. But that doesn't mean that we should exclude the possibility that other biochemistries might also be possible that don't rely on liquid water. Having said all that, though, Mars did have liquid water. So for Mars, at least, it remains a valid strategy, I think. The NASA follow the water strategy is still a valid strategy, given that we have to start somewhere. And if we're going to search for life, we might as well start searching for the kind of life we understand. And that does depend on water. And Mars did have water.
Of course, we have another neighbor in Venus, which I understand a lot of people are getting fairly excited about now in terms of the upper atmosphere and life.
Yes, Venus. So how long have you got? So currently, until the 1960s, everyone had high hopes for life on Venus because it's a completely cloud-covered planet. And therefore, the clouds sort of might have implied a source of oceans of liquid water that provide the water for the clouds, and therefore we could have oceans of liquid water and a warm tropical planet with life and everything. And then that went away as we gradually realized in the 60s and 70s that Venus is suffering from a runaway greenhouse effect. So the surface is now apart from the surface of the sun, the surface of Venus is the hottest surface anywhere in the solar system, thanks to its massive CO2 atmosphere and its runaway greenhouse effect. So the surface temperature on the surface of Venus is about 480 degrees Celsius, something like that. Liquid water is impossible. Life, as we understand it, is impossible. Anyway, this has led people to the fact the surface of Venus is totally uninhabitable today, has led people to speculate whether these thick clouds might support airborne life, microorganisms living in the clouds, and possibly had to migrate up to the clouds when the surface of Venus became uninhabitable. We don't know exactly when the runaway greenhouse effect cut in on Venus. It's possible life had evolved on Venus and the surface has become uninhabitable, the oceans have boiled away, and what life could had migrated to the clouds. Anyway, so there's been, over the decades, there's been quite a lot of speculation about these lines. But then a couple of years ago, Jane Greaves and colleagues thought they'd discovered a spectral line due to phosphine. That's a molecule, pH3. Or four, in the clouds of Venus, which is phosphine, is considered a potential biomarker in that the only, so that would be a molecule that indicates the presence of life, because no one can think of a plausible non-biological set of reactions that will produce phosphine in a planet's atmosphere, planet Venus's atmosphere, whereas there are microorganisms that do produce phosphine as a waste gas. So this did, a couple of years ago, cause a great deal of excitement. I have to say, though, much of that excitement, a bit like the Alan Hills 84001 story, has now died away.
Yeah.
As more scientists have studied the data and collected more data. It's not very difficult to take spectra of Venus. So get more scientists taking more data independently. I think the consensus is now building that this phosphine detection was probably spurious. Yeah. In which case the phosphine biomarker has gone away, in which case there's no any great evidence for life in the clouds of Venus. But again, a bit like the Alan Hills 84001 story, the fact that that biomarker's gone away does not mean that there is no life in the clouds of Venus. It's not making phosphine. So again, the way to get to the bottom of this is to explore Venus more thoroughly. More spacecraft, perhaps balloons floating in the atmosphere. So, I mean, the thick atmosphere of Venus lends itself to balloons. You could imagine balloons or aerial vehicles of various kinds in the clouds of Venus making measurements, searching for cloud-borne life. Yeah. But this is what it would take to get a definitive answer.
It seems to me that one of the things about the search for extraterrestrial life is that it's all going to cost a lot of money.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And what benefits do we actually get if we do find it, apart from academic status, of course?
Well, I'm not sure it does cost a lot of money. I think it costs, obviously, since a spacecraft or planet costs millions of euros or dollars or whatever. Compared to many other things the world spends money on, this is a pretty small drop in the ocean.
Indeed.
Take NASA's current budget. So what's that, $27 billion a year? So that sounds a huge amount of money. You can trust that with the US military budget, which is $100 billion, right? So I mean, you could argue that the US, for example, don't want to pick on the US, so could make a similar argument for the UK or anywhere else. You could make an argument that they may feel they need these big defense budgets, but they're orders of magnitude more expensive than what is paid for on exploring the universe. And only a fraction of what this costs, only a fraction of the NASA budget is spent on astrobiology. So relative to most of it's spent on things like the space station, which also have value, but they're different. So I'm not sure it's true that relative to the world economy as a whole, searching for life in the universe is very expensive. However, as for what we get out of it, it is a scientific quest, of course, and the ultimate quest is we want to know whether life on Earth is unique or not. And if it's not unique, how common is life elsewhere in the universe? And if life is common elsewhere in the universe, how far has it gone? How far has natural selection pushed extraterrestrial life in developing complexity or intelligence or technologies? So really, we're asking are we alone question, which I think is pretty fundamental to our worldview. In how we see ourselves in relation to the natural world, is whether this is the only planet with life upon it in the whole universe, or whether such life is common. Getting an answer to this question seems pretty, I would think, quite important component of of developing a worldview that properly articulates humanity's place in the universe. So ultimately, I mean, if that isn't a value, then, you know, I don't quite know what is a value, because it seems a pretty fundamental question to settle to me. We'll be right back.